Once again, good morning, good afternoon, depends wherever you are, to our show on books, books and beverages. I'm your host, Fred Kumalo.
Where's the beverage?
We're having a beverage.
I'm joking.
Oh, yeah. And Angela is making a point here that I've offered her a very low-grade beverage instead of our usual wine and whiskey and so on.
You know?
But it's only 10 o'clock in the morning.
Let's keep note of that, please.
Yeah, so I'm your host, and we're doing this under the auspices of City Press, whereby we interview top authors locally and internationally. So in the studio today, we are joined by Angela Makolwa, a novelist of note and journalist and a PR consultant. But here she is joining us in her capacity as a novelist, the author of Critical but Stable. I'm mentioning it because it's in the news right now. It was published locally a couple of years ago, but now it's been reassigned, given a new lease of life, published in the States, and it will be launched as in the next few weeks. But she's going to speak us through the whole process, where the process is at the moment, because the book hasn't been launched there over there yet. And we've got she's published, as I say, a number of highly received, highly rated novels in South Africa on contemporary issues, gender, violence, and social class, and many other things that she's going to speak to us about. So we are here to just tease her out on her journey as a writer. So perhaps we start with the book that is in the news right now, and then we retrace our steps back to where you started, how you started.
Sure. Okay. I'm waiting for a question.
Okay. You started with Red Ink.
Yes.
That was your first novel.
Yeah.
And it has just been reprinted with a new cover overseas and all that. Take us through that journey, culminating in Critical but Stable.
Okay, yeah. So Red Ink I wrote in 2006, 2007. So it was my debut novel, and its genesis actually was from an encounter that I'd had with somebody that I had intended to interview as a journalist. His name is Moses Sithole. I suppose I can mention it now because I think there's enough time that has passed.
Yes.
So he was a serial killer at the time, and, you know, he'd been terrorizing and horrifically, killing women. And, so this was around 1995. So I'd followed the case right until he was sentenced. And then when he was imprisoned, I wrote to him wanting to, you know, just have an interview with him, you know, behind bars, for him to tell just what I was curious about as a woman and as somebody who kind of fitted his victim profile, because his victim profile was young black women, job seekers. and I wanted to understand, because we'd not in South Africa had that level of criminal before. We'd not dealt with serial homicide.
Sure.
In the mid-90s. And also remember, this was literally just coming from our democracy, receiving our democracy.
He has since died, Moses.
No, he's not. He calls me still.
Really?
He's still very much alive.
Okay.
He has moved prisons, like he's moved correctional facilities over time. He's now in Limpopo, the Louis Trichardt facility. It's a maximum security private prison. Mm. So that's where he is now. So basically the book was based on him. I interviewed him, and he wanted me to write a book about him, which I at first was, you know, skeptical about, but eventually I did decide to take on the project because I thought it was important to understand the psychology of somebody like that. The psychology of evil, essentially.
Sure.
Yeah.
But your next book was very different from
it was that. Much lighter, because I needed that light relief. Yes.
Yeah. Making that transition, just tell us about that. What does it do to your headspace as a writer?
Much needed. It was much needed because Red Ink was very dark. And so with the 30th candle, I was actually turning 30 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just wanted to, talk about being a young woman, and the pressures, I suppose, when you reach that milestone. And I think it doesn't apply to only women. There's a certain social pressure that comes with different milestones. And 30 is one of those big ones where, you know, at the time, at least I felt that I needed to be somewhere in, with regards to my relationships and my career. And I needed to have achieved, ticked a couple of boxes in terms of, I don't know, the things that you attain in life, to be seen to be grown up. I mean, once you hit 30, you know, in your 20s, you can still get away with, you know, kind of juvenile behavior, I would say, at least at the time, that's how I felt. It was interesting I suppose quite enriching for me to explore things that were different, issues that were different from, you know, that darkness, that criminality and that grittiness, and just deal with normal issues that young people, you know, deal with. And, and it was extremely well received. And I think it was my first foray into, what I'm now seen as, which is a kind of comical. I mean, I do bring in a lot of comedy in my writing, even the darker type of writing. I do bring in a lot of comedy. So
I see a lot of PG Woodhouse, and I love comedy writing and reading. And we've seen that a light thread, flowing through your next projects, where you deal with, gender issues, obviously, but also class. Class comes in strongly in your projects. What's your attraction to commentary on class in South Africa right now?
I think with The Blessed Girl, which I think was my fourth novel, it was really interesting to witness that phenomenon of, you know, the sugar baby and sugar daddy kind of dynamic. And what was interesting to me was that I work with a lot of young women. I'm surrounded by a lot of young women, and, you know, on the surface, it would, you know, there were a lot of causalities, theories around why this was happening. And so a popular kind of thread of thought was that this was caused by, you know, the imbalance in our social dynamics, the poverty trap. So there was a predominant thought that this was something where young women were trying to escape the poverty trap. But for me, what I was observing around me was that I had a lot of young women who were graduates and who really, some of them seemed to even come from middle class homes, who were also drawn to the blesser lifestyle, the blesser blessee lifestyle. And so it occurred to me that there's just something deeper that is happening in South Africa beyond, you know, kind of the lazy assignment of this to the poverty trap. And yes, that is a genuine issue that does give rise to it, but there's more to it than that. And for me, in my exploration of the blesser blessee dynamic, and speaking to young women in the lifestyle, and speaking to even a few men, but more informally with the men, because obviously a lot of men would not want to speak about it or be interviewed as blessers, but I did find the women much more forthcoming. And my sense was that it also emanated from the instant search for instant gratification, the search for instant millions, instant social status.
So it's necessarily an issue of desperation and destitution. It's people being attracted to bling bling. And they think the blesser route is the way
to go. The blesser route is the easiest. And I found that also social media had a lot to do with it. And remember when I wrote it, as much as social media has exploded to a much higher level now, you have influencers literally living off of that lifestyle. But at the time, it was still kind of, it's in its infancy, but it definitely did have, and I believe that the phenomenon, the blesser blessee phenomenon, has created a certain aesthetic, like a lifestyle aesthetic that young women aspire towards. And the women that are living this lifestyle, at first they were ridiculed as slay queens and so on. But there's also a very interesting shift that's happening where they are respected and they're almost seen as you know, just a legitimate kind of a gig that a person is chasing, like a legitimate way of getting the bag, as they say. So In its infancy, I think that phenomenon has birthed where we are now with, you know, the influencer lifestyle being an actual job that is respected. Mm-hmm. And there's less questioning. I mean, there's obviously still that skepticism that comes up when there's a fall of a slay queen, because of the realization that a lot of this is for show. It's for us, to envy and, you know, to wish that we could be a part of it, but it's mostly for show. So a lot of it is just an illusion that is being put on. A lot of the cars are not really owned by, you know, the people and so on, you know, the whole thing. So, but it's also a very, I know it, when I've gone to other countries, I've gone to Kenya, where, I mean, in the early stages of The Blessed Girl, and people said, oh, we know exactly who Bontle is, which is the main character. and they named a person.
Locally, in Kenya.
Somebody showed me a video of this girl. And I can tell you, I've never been so gobsmacked, because she literally spoke the way that I could hear Bontle Tau, which is my protagonist, speaks. She said the things that Bontle would say, you know, and she presented herself in the way that Bontle would present herself.
So there are Bontles all over.
There are Bontles in Lagos. I'm sure there's plenty of Bontles in Lagos. Plenty.
Yeah. Okay, now, so for the benefit of our listeners, before we got into the studio, we were talking about critical but stable, the life it has assumed. What's happening with that book? Can you status with when it came out in South Africa, how it was received? Now it's got a new cover. It's published in the US. Take us through that. What were the dynamics involved?
Yeah, so critical but stable. Borrowing from what you're saying about my focus on class dynamics, which I think we don't talk about enough here in South Africa, because I think, you know, traditionally, class dynamics were about black and white. You know, the white people were the wealthy class, and black people were the poorer and downtrodden class. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, with our democracy and shifts in the economy and the rise of the black middle class, there's definitely a class system that has been emerging over the past, I would say, 20 years. And so critical but stable is another take on that. And it is different. It's a shift from The Blessed Girl in that it focuses on four couples, married couples. Mm. Most of them, their wealth is legitimate. There's one or two where it's questionable. Mm. And I make that point because there is a big issue of, you know, whether it's, we can debate whether it's a legitimate assumption or not. But there's a big issue where if black people are hugely successful, there's a big question mark on how they gain that wealth.
I know.
Yeah. And so what was important, to me, writing this book was not only asserting, you know, the fact that there's a lot of black people who are doing well for themselves, and it is not through only ill-gotten gains. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an important point, because I think a lot of well-to-do black people actually choose to stay away from social media and not post and all of that, because immediately, once one does that, it kind of explodes into how did they get it, and a digging, and oh yes, we knew this was too good to be true. So it was important for me, firstly, to accept that there are hardworking people who have earned their,
and they need to be acknowledged, well, and celebrated,
and celebrated legitimately. Mm-hmm. And then the other issue that I address with critical but stable is the different dynamics in how then the black middle, these guys, somebody said they're not middle class, they're above middle class. The upper middle class relates to, the people that work for them, the working class. So your security, your, domestic workers. And there's a very interesting dynamic around that in critical but stable, with one of the couples and how they relate to their domestic help. And then also the other issue that was very interesting for me to explore and quite important to explore was the issue of of Afrophobia or xenophobia, which has now, of course, exploded into something else, that is now has been taken to the streets with Operation Tutula and all of that. But also, because for me, what is interesting about the Afrophobia is that, firstly, obviously, that it is being meted out against, you know, particularly Black Africans
and poorer ones
at that, who are living in South Africa. And that it's completely ignored that there's other nationalities of a different hue who are involved in illegal activities that are completely like going on about their business and not feeling that daily threat, you know, that Black Africans feel in South Africa at the moment. But the other part of the equation is that we do have porous borders and that like there's a character there in my book who's extremely Afrophobic. He's a security guard and he witnesses what he thinks is a crime. This book is a mystery, a comedy, a drama. So it starts with a dead body of a married woman. And we find out that, you know, this married woman is probably likely part of the four couples that we get to know so well. And that she was probably having an affair because, you know, the dead body, is being looked at, by somebody who is clearly a lover to the person who is lying dead in bed. And so you've got the security guard who thinks he's witnessed this crime. And he is so elated because the person that he suspects as the perpetrator, and he thinks
is a foreigner.
So he cannot wait because this is the day that he's been waiting for, to see a foreigner fall, to see the downfall of a foreigner. And remember also, this foreign man, that he suspects to have committed the crime is living a life, that to him is something that he can only dream of. He can only aspire to because he's living in an upmarket, complex in, you know, the northern suburbs and all of that. So it is important to kind of also not just brush away what is at the heart of the issue, that there are people who are saying, my goodness, I've been in this country for so long, I've toiled for so long, and I cannot seem to make it, you know? And, you know, and so I just feel that the issue is much more layered than what we would like it to seem.
Sure. So tell us about Critical But Stable being released in America.
So Critical But Stable and The 30th Candle have both landed publishing rights from Lake Union, which is an imprint of Amazon. It's a book imprint of Amazon. Critical But Stable will be released at bookstores in the US, the UK, Nigeria, Kenya, different parts of the world, by Lake Union, in November. So that's Critical But Stable. So it's currently available on the Amazon platform, overseas, as a short-term promotional, activity just to get it out to Amazon subscribers, and to get the word out and create some buzz. But yes, it will officially hit the bookshelves in November. And then The 30th Candle, I've just finished. We were speaking with Fred before the podcast about the interesting editing process that you have to go through when you're dealing with an international publisher versus the process that you go through with our local publishers. And they are equally thorough, the processes, but what has been interesting for me is a specific focus on what they call bias. So I think as human beings, we all have
gender, race,
and we have blind spots, right? Yeah, we have blind spots. that we think we do not have, like that we don't think are biased when we put them to paper. Because of course, as a writer, you do try to respect all your audiences, even when you're addressing difficult issues, like, for instance, xenophobia or Afrophobia, like gender-based violence. And of course, there's that balancing act of wanting your characters to sound as genuine as possible. So, you know, an abusive man will use a lot of profanities when fighting with a woman, right? But so, for instance, it's not about trying to censor yourself and trying to make the person say, "Oh, my lady, I will beat you up slowly." Of course, they're not, because people don't speak like that.
Yeah.
In that heated moment, the character would still So the kind of things that I fight for instance, Fred, is that I wouldn't want a Xhosa man who's abusive having a fight with his Zulu wife, but sounding like the perfect English gentleman.
Of course not. Yeah.
So of course I would not allow that. Yeah, yeah. But at the same
time, doesn't ring true. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we were talking about just those nuances. However, I am willing to give respect to the fact that there's certain things that, because I'm not homosexual, for instance, I've got a lot of homosexual characters in my book. I may not understand that something that I'm describing, and I'm thinking that I'm describing it in a sensitive a manner as possible, may land differently when being read by somebody who is of a different sexuality from mine. So I did appreciate that process. I did fight for the things that I thought we're fighting for. Mm-hmm. And I did fight for issues of cultural discrepancies, like that we are Africans and there's certain ways that we do things and there's certain ways that may not make sense to you as somebody sitting in the US or the UK. Mm-hmm. But this is how we do things. It may look or may sound odd or come across as odd, but this is what this character would do or say in this particular instance.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
And congratulations on the US publication of the book.
Thank you.
And a little bird whispered to me the other day that these birdies are everywhere, you see. That one of your books, I don't know if you're at liberty to speak about that, one of your books is being adapted for the screen. Tell us about that, if you are at liberty to.
Yeah, it's actually three of the books, finally. Okay. Officially, okay. I can say that.
Okay.
One has just wrapped production, but I'm not at liberty to say which one.
Okay.
And then two are going into development. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited, but I still can't. There's something very exciting for me as an author that I will share with you offline. that normally doesn't happen, that I'm quite excited is happening with this particular process. I mean, adaptations are complicated things. Mm-hmm. And I think for the author, they're not always the happy ending that you may envisage it to be. I think you do get flattered, of course, as an author when you're approached by a producer or whomever wanting to adapt your book for screenplay. But the reality of it is that with a lot of adaptations, authors are not as involved in the process as maybe they would assume, or I don't know if it's naively or if they are entitled to assume it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times you're not as involved as you would like to be. Mm-hmm. And it may lead to, I don't know, just kind of some disillusionment in the way that things kind of roll out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm happy to say that with one or two of the adaptations that are, you know, currently, that are currently in process, I am thankfully and very gratefully a little bit more involved, than, which makes me feel acknowledged as the originator of the work. And I know that, screenplay is different from novel writing.
Sure.
And I fully appreciate that, it's not always easy to involve an author because, you know, textual work is different from screen work. But I think it's different. I don't know how you feel about this, by the way. I'd actually love to hear your thoughts. I'm sure it's different for different writers.
Well, I've never written a screenplay myself.
But I'm saying if your work were to be adapted for screenplay, what would be your level of expectation in terms of your involvement, just broadly, just like the big stuff, not the small stuff?
I'd love to be a consultant.
At the very least.
Not to watch from the sidelines.
I mean, with some of these processes, I mean, with one of them, I've literally felt like I'm just kind of like the kid that was just dragged from the street and said, hey, what do you think of the World Cup? Oh, I think it should be held in South Africa. Okay, great. Bye. And then they go on and they host it in South Africa. They do everything. And you get to see the game happen a few years later and you're like, but
that was mine. No. But we have to be kind of, while we are grateful, we have to be quietly forceful as writers to say, this was our idea. We need a stake, a piece of this cake as well. But if we don't assert our right as producers of these things, they will run and they'll just continue dragging us around. And
I've literally been told by a producer who is not really involved in any of my works, but was just telling me as a helpful, in inverted commas, bystander, that the conventional wisdom is get the writer to be as far away from this thing as possible. That's the conventional wisdom. Because they're going to mess it up, apparently.
Well, Stephen King started out like this, but now he owns everything. So he is involved.
Yeah, even Dion Mayer locally, I think he's doing a great job of owning his work. Yeah, so we will get there. And I think also we also have to have an appreciation of the fact that some writers actually don't want to be involved, but at least have license to say, I don't want to be involved. Not let it be assumed, or at least let it not be wished that you should be as far away from the thing as possible.
Great stuff. There's so much to talk about, but we want to thank Angela for coming to our studio and gracing us with her intellectual presence. Thank you for writing these books. People out there, the books are available at bookstores locally. You can buy them online.
Yeah.
And as we are saying, they are being given a new lease of life, being adapted for the screen. We just have to wait a bit to see the final result. But we need to celebrate, acknowledge our local writers, because there's so many beautiful books being produced in this country. But it's just that. We don't see them. We don't get to see them. Maybe it's the marketing, maybe it's the distribution, but we have to push.
Yeah,
as readers out there, we have to push and acknowledge and celebrate the social media, celebrate local writing on your platforms.
I couldn't have said it better. So thank you so much for having me, Fred. And thanks actually for starting this whole thing for us. You were the pioneer. I always tell you, I read a short story that, Fred, you don't even remember the short story that I read when I was young. I think I was about 15 or something. I read a short story of yours that was part of a compilation of short stories, a collection of short stories. And
Ramu the Hermit, it must be.
It must have been.
In the finishing touch. So
I read it and I loved it. And only later did I realize that it's written by a black writer. And I thought, oh my goodness, I didn't think it's possible. And I think that's where a bit of the grain of thought that maybe this is something that I could do one day was planted. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Once again, this is Books and Beverages hosted by Fred Kumalo under the auspices of City Press.